Hello, I'm Han Brown, and thanks for tuning in. This conversation is live streaming on all the various social media platforms. I feature guests to speak on the topic of Alzheimer's because we all need to advocate for those living with dementia. We do that through awareness and empower those family members and people who live with the disease. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive, degenerative neurological disorder that slowly destroys memory and cognitive abilities. An estimated 6.2 million Americans of all ages are living with Alzheimer's disease in 2021. That's about 1 in 9 people, about 11.3% age 65 and older has Alzheimer's disease. So the number of cases is expected to triple by 2050 as the baby boomer generation ages. Although there are medications available to treat symptoms such as memory loss or confusion, these do not cure the underlying condition in most patients. Also, due to the high costs and insurance restrictions, many people cannot afford treatment for this devastating illness. While we don't have a cure for Alzheimer's yet, there are some promising therapies that may provide relief from symptoms or even slow down its progression in certain individuals. Researchers are working on ways to prevent or delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease through lifestyle changes such as diet and exercise to lower your risk for developing it later in life. So join me today is Dr. George Perry, Professor of Biology, University of Texas, and the Dean of College of Sciences. He will share his work in Living with Aging, Alzheimer's, the Disease of Our Time. So Dr. George Perry, welcome to the show.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much for this invitation and to talk about a topic that impinges on so many people these days.
Great. Thank you for your time. So aside from your professional work, can you share with us a little bit about yourself on a personal level?
Personal level. Most of the time I spend myself focused on work, which consists of research and teaching. But on a personal level, I do a lot of things for the Portuguese community, Portuguese American community in Portugal. Things with my family. I have two wonderful daughters, and my wife and I enjoy being with them, traveling otherwise, especially prior to COVID.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, thanks for being here. Well, let's get started. So now, what is the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia?
Dementia is the broad category of cognitive or loss of function, higher function. So that can be brought on by strokes, it could be brought on by head trauma, it could be a disease or a condition that results when you're in youth. So it's a generalized category. Age-related dementia, which is where most Alzheimer's disease is, it usually strikes people either in late middle age or advanced age. During that phase, about 60% of dementia has Alzheimer's disease as its basis. Other reasons you could have dementia for the aged would be strokes, would be a major cause, and strokes overlap Alzheimer's disease. In addition to strokes, diffuse Lewy body disease, some people with Parkinson's disease, frontal temporal dementia, there's a long list of conditions, all of which are very serious conditions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now what are the main stages that a person moves through as they develop Alzheimer's?
If it's classic Alzheimer's disease, if it's carefully examined by both the caregiver or family member or a neurologist, some of the initial changes will be changes in mood. More susceptibility for depression, maybe fits of anger, et cetera, because there's an involvement of the brainstem early on. Then, but most of the time, it's not detected that early. And then the next phase would be short-term memory loss. And the distinction would be not that you can't find your car keys, but actually that you don't understand what the car keys do. Things like that. So you don't understand common things. And then there's a progression from that, which is mainly in the hippocampus, a region of the brain that's important in incorporating short-term memories. Then it will spread throughout, and there'll be other behavioral changes and loss of reasoning, and eventually ability to, you know, in the later phases there, there'll be loss of mobility and probably confinement to a bed. But that is not the whole course of Alzheimer's disease where someone has lost all function. The more normal course during these parts where you can't remember your keys or what they do, maybe you shouldn't be driving during some part of that course. And there are guidelines for that. But you can function in many different ways and live with a family, and it's a matter of modifying your life to fit that. And I can answer more of that. But some foundations, like the Alzheimer Foundation of America, just designed an apartment about how you'd have an apartment for somebody that had cognitive loss. Modifying the environment for the people to take advantage of the of what's retained is really makes a huge difference. For example, not having loose-fitting rugs that people might trip on, having bright colors because visual acuity is dropped, and hearing aids, if they're not hearing, to say, oh, well, they don't need to hear because they're demented. Actually, that is being able to see well and being able to hear well and having the sensory input is an important part of maintaining cognition. When that's deprived, usually the patients decline much faster.
Mm-hmm. I also think, at least on a personal level, when one sense may reduce, the other one increases. It gets better.
That's what we can hope. Yeah, by optimizing things for certain aspects. And accepting, the other part is the biggest problem for families with people with Alzheimer's disease is not cognitive or memory loss, it's behavioral aspects. And the behavioral aspects can be very distinct, and those are reasons that people end up, the major reason people end up in nursing homes is because wandering, aggression, other things. So I think it's also very critical, especially the average Alzheimer person is not 65 years old, although people can be 65 or 55. Those are relatively rare. The more common thing is the people are 85 years old or plus, because your chance of having the disease, when you were mentioning that the baby boomers are going to have more, well, there's a paradox. Actually, your chance of having Alzheimer's disease at any given age is actually reduced in recent years. But more people are living a greater age, and that's the greatest risk. So if you live beyond age 85, your chance is about one-third to 60% with a greater penetrance of minorities for unknown reasons. It's probably very much like COVID. It's not something that you can easily tease apart. It's diabetes, underlying education, nutrition, etc. Another part, well, we'll talk about, yeah, you have, we'll have questions later about what you can do to reduce the risk. But dealing with the cognitive changes, and those are individual differences. Some people are going to have more visual problems. Some people may have hallucinations. And seeing a neurologist as well as a psychiatrist and getting the care that's personalized. And not just to say, well, my mother is 85 or 95, what else would you expect? You should expect them to be optimized the best they can be for whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about it before the live. And that is, there is life even when one is diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And there's a lot of life, and that's what we ought to focus on, despite
Correct.
The decline.
And that is, you know, in our modern society, modern extending back at least, let's say, 30 years before now and extending forward, when people will be living into the 80s, many people, Alzheimer's is going to be a phase of life for a significant number of them. And it can be where they're all walled off from society and they have no value, or they can be integrated into society. A colleague of mine, Peter Whitehouse, actually designed intergenerational schools and had people with Alzheimer's disease teaching in the school. That doesn't make sense, does it? Well, people with Alzheimer's disease can read books to children. They can share life stories with them, and that can be enriching for both. But that's just replaying, you know, the nuclear family of the past, where grandparents or great-grandparents would still live with the family and play a role in childcare. But I don't know if we can return to that, but how can we engage people? One of the key things of reducing your chance of having Alzheimer's disease and relevant for even somebody with it is to have a meaningful life. And being walled off from family and society is not a way to have a meaningful life. It's when you're contributing. And people do not need to have, you know, IQs of 160 to contribute to life. They can contribute in many different ways. So instead of focusing on the end stage of the disease, well, for all of us, the end stage of us is being dead. So we could focus on that, or we can say you can focus on somebody with Alzheimer's when they have no, almost no capacity. Prior to then, they're going to have many capacities, and many of them that could be useful, and useful to their family, useful to society. And that plays an important role in maintaining them as people.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that. Absolutely. So now, what are some of the top risk factors for developing Alzheimer's disease?
Well, what's come out over the last few years, the risk factors and the things you could do to reduce your risk of having sort of are intertwined together. So the, you could say things like head trauma does increase your risk. And head trauma is an extremely common event. If you've been in a car accident, I was when I was a child, that means you're possibly higher risk later in life. Maybe playing football, but it's not so clear cut. Okay. It's not like everybody who plays football and has head trauma will develop dementia. That's not it, but it does statistically plays a role. Other part is nutrition. Midlife obesity, protection, education plays a role. That doesn't mean you need to have a PhD, but it means having an educated life, being mentally active, stress reduction, and protection from depression. And that relates back to what I was talking about having a meaning for life. And meditation, or things like meditation, all of those that lower stress levels play an important role. The other piece that's come out in the last decade is that people of minority groups are much more susceptible to having Alzheimer's disease. And we don't really know why. It's probably unlikely to be mostly genetic. It's probably more likely to be lifestyle events, much as we saw for COVID. People in minority groups, and probably it also extends to socioeconomic among white groups too, though the studies haven't been done to validate that.
Very true. So now, what are the current treatments or therapies for Alzheimer's?
Yeah, and I should back up. One other thing is genetics. Depending on whether you, if you have a clear inheritance in the family with early onset, meaning like in your 50s and 60s, then you may have a determinant gene. Those are really rare. Less than 1% of people who have Alzheimer's disease have that. But there's another gene, a risk factor, apolipoprotein E. And if you inherit the E4 form, which is 20% of the United States population contains it, you're at about threefold higher risk. So while it's 20% of the general population, it's 50% of people with Alzheimer's disease because it's that much enriched. So it is a factor. Does that mean that you need to do something else? It really doesn't tell you a lot. In the sense that just means you're at higher risk. You can contain an APOE4 gene and not develop disease, and half the people have Alzheimer's and don't have it either. And you can, if somebody is interested in getting that, any of the DNA sequencing companies that sell genealogy or health data could determine that for you. The question you asked?
Back on the DNA and the protein. So basically, let's say if you run the test, you come back that you are at the higher risk. Your choices are the same. You continue to do with what you're doing as far as healthy lifestyle.
That is exactly. I was involved in one of the consensus reports about why there was a value to do this. I thought it wasn't a value, okay? Because I personally do not know my genotype. And I have been sequenced unbelievable level because I do genealogy and I'm always trying to get as much data as I can because I thought if I know, I would just create more tension and there's really not much I can do about it except what I should be doing already. So yeah. If you knew this, yeah, you should, you know, lower fat in your diet. You should, you know, exercise, et cetera. Those are the same things that are already. Could that change in the future? Of course, as we have have better treatments. So you asked a question about where are we on treatments.
Yeah, the current treatments or therapies.
The current therapies are symptomatic treatment, the ones that are broadly used. And they're in two categories. Well, I'll go to a third, actually. So they're in two categories. One of them focuses on cholinergic neurotransmission. Some of the neurons involved in the disease early on are those involved in maintaining cognition in the brain, and they use a chemical called acetylcholine to transmit their information. And what companies did is they developed a drug to be able to promote the remaining activity that's there. So neurons are lost. They did a way to enhance them, much along the same logic that's done with L-DOPA for Parkinson's disease, which has benefit at least in the early phase of the disease. For Alzheimer's, the best-known drug of this category is Aricept. And Aricept has some benefit for maybe a third of patients for 6 months to a year. So the benefits are relatively small. The cost is relatively small, and the side effects are not life-threatening. The main side effect is constipation and some other issues, but you can discontinue the medication at that point, and that's very often why people don't continue it throughout the whole course of the disease. Another drug, so there are three drugs like that, and then there's one drug called Namenda, which relates to the glutamatergic pathway and inhibits it. And what it does is it's more in later stages of the disease and has some benefit. If you were to look at these statistically, the benefit is very small. But then again, price and side effects are very small. A new drug was approved by the FDA this summer. I've written a lot about it because I don't think it's a drug that I would recommend. Well, I know I would recommend. And that is because drugs are always a blend between efficacy and side effects. All drugs have side effects. Some drugs have really strong side effects. But if they do, usually it's balanced by a huge amount of benefit. This particular drug did not benefit people cognitively in almost any of the trials. There have been 20 trials. This is the only one that showed a borderline effect, what's called post hoc analysis. It means you analyze things after the fact. And then it still wasn't clear it really benefited the patients. usually what companies do, and I'm involved in companies, if you do post-hoc analysis, you use that as the basis for designing a new trial. You don't ask for approval because the data is already suspect. So this drug is neither effective nor safe. And the safety is that patients who get the drug have cerebral bleeding, they have brain swelling, and the brain shrinks. The brain itself shrinks.
Do you think
40% of patients show these side effects?
40%
show the side effects, and it wasn't too much of a health issue in the trial, but they were really carefully monitored. Biogen spent over $1.5 billion doing this trial. So it was executed in an extremely meticulous way. And when you're administering this to patients in hospitals that have lower capacity, in terms of ability to monitor people, or patients have the issue of paying for all of these extra tests, or the discomfort of showing up for all of these tests, that is, it required brain imaging every few months.
Wow.
And so you have to go in for an infusion every month. You have to be monitored to see if your brain is having a problem, to see if it should be discontinued every few months. And the cost is $56,000 per year for just the drug, not for the monitoring.
Right. So if it's so effective, and if it's the purpose is to help the mass, it sounds like it's helping the 1% with that price point.
Yeah, if people have to pay for it, it will be for the 1% that are rich enough to pay for it. But if it was only helping the 1% of people that were economically able to pay for it, they would have a hard time recovering their money.
Right.
So Biogen is trying very hard to get it to be covered by Medicare. And this will have a big effect on the Medicare system because the cost at $56,000 per year, or estimated to be closer to $100,000 by the time you do all the tests. So what I think another part of this and the logic the FDA used in approving it is the logic used for cancer drugs, chemotherapy drugs. And if you think of those, my mother, my family doesn't have Alzheimer's disease. We have cancer and heart disease. So my mother had cancer and had chemotherapy. You take these drugs that are extremely toxic. They do cause you to live a bit longer. They're very costly. They're very painful. And I would really hate to see Alzheimer's disease go down that model because the quality of life is so jeopardized. But that was the logic actually used because chemotherapeutic agents are approved based on shrinking the tumor, and the Biogen drug shrunk the amyloid in the brain. And I've argued for over 20 years that the amyloid is a normal part of the biology of the brain, and removing it would be more likely to be harmful than beneficial.
Boy, no, that's a different topic, right? Because
yes,
the amyloid is not the enemy.
Not the enemy. You know, it's like inflammation of the brain, which is, or anywhere else, inflammation is what, causes arthritis or other types of problems because it's over-accentuated. But if you don't have it, you aren't able to repair your body. You know, there's always a blend in your body between repair and degeneration.
Yeah. I think a month ago, I had Dr. Alberto Aspe speak specifically to this topic of amyloid. And I guess if anybody that's listening right now that wants to hear the in-depth live discussion, you could check out the YouTube channel. The video is over there. But now, with regard to therapies, now put the Biogen ecanemab aside. So what types of therapies do you think that are currently most promising?
Well, I could say the ones that I'm, working with companies, but I would, I'll divorce it from that. Is one of the biggest insights that's happened over the last 10 or 15 years is realizing Alzheimer's disease is actually not so deterministic. the genetics really misled us, thinking it was amyloid and it was a deterministic, you have this problem and whole thing follows from that. Instead, Alzheimer's disease is becoming more like heart disease, multifactorial and associated with lifestyle, where genes play a role, but they're not the whole story. And how has this come about is understanding the lifestyle contribution. The fact that minorities have 2 to 3-fold higher risk. I mean, that's a big difference. That seeing that people that eat large amounts of vegetables, lower stress, actually may reduce their risk of having the disease by 50 to 90%. That's an age-related risk, because you have to always think, everyone says, I will do this and I will lower my chance of having disease. You actually could be increasing your chance because you're going to live longer. What you really have to look at is increasing your health span. In other words, all of us want to live to 95 and be completely healthy, but maybe when we get to 96, if we're still alive, we'll have some other condition that would be there. But it's better that it's at 96 and not, you know, 76 or 66. So back to all of those have been really important insights. The other part in terms of companies and new therapeutics, some people are focusing on trying to restore the connections in the brain, synapse connections, trying to restore the scar tissue that develops around plaques, trying to immobilize it, other things. So, but if you look at one of the problems that's been for the amyloid approach, isn't just Biogen. All of the big money in pharma has gone to the amyloid approach for 30 years. All the best and brightest people at the most prestigious institutions have tied their whole career down that approach. And therefore, all of the other approaches have been tremendously underfunded. The only one that might be similar to the amyloid in a sense of funding is studying the proteins involved with forming tangles, the tau protein. And but my own argument is that the tau protein has a lot of similarities to what's happening with the amyloid. Both of them, tau and amyloid, have antioxidant properties. Very distinct antioxidant properties that are protecting the brain.
So I want to ask this question. So why do you think clinicians are chasing after the same amyloid theory for the past 30 years and yet not showing something that's effective? Perhaps we could be more open-minded. I mean, why? What is your recommendation?
It's a combination of things. First thing is the people that develop Alzheimer's disease at an early age, and it shows clear inheritance in the family. This is not APOE. It's mutations in the amyloid precursor protein, the protein that eventually forms the amyloid, or some proteins that degrade the amyloid and play a role in its formation, the presenilins 1 and 2. So because of that genetic link to the disease, several key people came up with the idea that this must be the cause of the disease. Mutations, develops Alzheimer's disease, must be the cause. They missed sort of basic biology. And to confirm that this was basic biology, what I now teach is basic biology, freshman biology. I wanted to be certain that what these people were missing, they should have learned when they were a freshman in college. I can confirm that because I teach that, is that when you're doing genetic studies, you're just looking at association. In other words, I have this mutation, I develop a disease. It doesn't define the mechanism, doesn't define the dependence. It just tells you that I have a red finger and I develop Alzheimer's disease, but I don't know why the red finger has anything to do with it. So, and then there's the opposite view, is that the amyloid has nothing to do with the disease, okay? So there's been those two views. So I and my colleagues that thought similarly, we came up with the idea that neither were right, that the genetics told you, that the amyloid was important, but it doesn't tell you how it's important. It could be that it has to be this playing this protective role, and if it doesn't do it right, that allows the disease to happen or something else. So they, along their study, so when that first idea came out, my colleague Mark Smith and I wrote an article called Amyloid Junkies. And it was published in Nature, very short, and saying, how do you know that this is going to be the treatment? And the best way to test that is going to be to remove it from the brain and see if it benefits patients. Well, that has been done 22 times in the well-done clinical studies. And in none of the studies was anybody ever saved or recovered or came back. What was done in between, people did vaccines of mice. And they had amyloid plaques. They removed the amyloid plaques and the mice were better. Problem with that is that those plaques were created. So you have something, you have a mouse that's normal. You genetically manipulate it. You put plaques in it. Now you remove it and it's back to normal. Surprise. I say it's very similar to studying respiratory distress with plastic bags over the head. It's very easy to cure. You just move the bag because it's not part of the biology. It's not COPD or tuberculosis or anything else. So the mice have been cured, but when people applied it to humans, it didn't. So why do people still persist when it's been tested this way? Why? Because the best and brightest and most powerful people in the field say it's still valid. They're still writing that it's valid and that we're likely to get better and better with treatment. But we removed the amyloid. And in the Biogen study, there were over 3,000 patients treated. There were no miraculous recoveries. And the patients were treated very early. So there were still no miracles that came out. So it's persisting because the power of personality, of people pushing. And in the pharmaceutical industry, Biogen invested $1.5 billion, but they're not the only one. Lilly's invested huge amounts of money, Roche, the list goes on. So the thought is that it might have been between $20 to $40 billion has been invested in by pharmaceutical industry, as well as funders, the NIH, the Alzheimer's Association, and others. Have done so. My friend, deceased friend now, Sharon Begley from Stat Magazine, who we had many conversations over decades, wrote a couple years ago about the amyloid cabal, that there was a lot of collusion. The collusion does not mean that people are doing anything good or bad, but they've all decided that that's the answer. And I think they do so with a great degree of seriousness and introspection. But science is based on evidence. Everything, that's another part I teach in Biology 1. If you can't show something is false, it's not part of science. It doesn't mean it isn't true. It just isn't scientifically true. So the amyloid idea has been tested numerous times. And this particular one, the Biogen, since it was the best documented, the patients were imaged all the way through and showed that all of them had the amyloid removed. And they didn't improve. The only way you see the improvement is you analyze subgroups. I call it analyzing the Eskimos, but of course that's not politically correct. But you could say those people with APOE genotype, which is what in fact they did, E4 people. So if you analyze enough small enough groups, you start to find statistical validity. But that's not considered to be a valid test. It's only useful. And I'm working with companies that do the same thing. We reanalyze the data, but on the basis of it, we design new trials. We don't ask for approval.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned this already, but that creates a trust issue and false hope. You know, and I think we talked about this a little bit before the live event is that, do you think it's more important now than ever, the folks, family members, caregivers, and the ones diagnosed with dementia, We need to empower them to ask these questions, to challenge the treatment, and to have a stronger voice. Do you agree with that?
I think so. Yes, I do. But, you know, all of us need to trust. I take medication for my conditions, not Alzheimer's, but other conditions. I actually never read the enclosure, okay, because I trust that the FDA has done that analysis and the efficacy versus the side effects is a positive balance. If we don't trust that, how can we do it? And patients, this is your family member, and especially if you have the financial means to pay for it yourself, saying, why can't I do this? And I've read many patients. I want hope. I want to feel, and I understand that need for hope. But, you know, this is what the FDA, my understanding in the early 1900s, why it was instituted, because people sold so many quack, you know, snake oil drugs, and they would analyze them to make sure that the balance was, and the FDA was the world standard for this. Some other countries only require that the drugs be safe. And this particular combination, it isn't either one.
So now, what is your goal as a professor, scientist, researcher with regard to Alzheimer's therapies? What are you working right now? What is your goal?
So my primary goal, aside from working with some companies dealing with synapse formation and changes in extracellular matrix proteins, my major focus is something that I've been studying since I was a student, and that's oxidative stress. And this is what amyloid plays an important role in doing. It reduces the amount of oxidative stress. So what is oxidative stress? It's the ability of oxygen in the air to react with our body to cause damage to it. And it's why people take vitamin E, why they eat blueberries. All of those things are related to fighting oxidative stress. And amyloid plays a role in that. And what we've been doing is trying to understand the mechanism of it. And we know now that it involves metals, dealing with iron and copper. Iron and copper levels don't change that much in the brain during Alzheimer's disease. How they're organized is tremendously changed. And so our current theory is that the amyloid plays a role in recycling metals from turnover of cell components. I know that's a little technical, but that if you don't turn, when your body is constantly renewing itself, for neurons, they live as long as you live. They were formed when you were a child, and they will persist to the end of your days. But the internal components of them are constantly being renewed. And as they're being renewed and regenerated, the metals are being released from their components, and they have to be repackaged. And that's what we think amyloid is doing, that is playing a role in repackaging so that it doesn't cause damage. And along that line, we made what I know is a really important discovery a couple months ago, and that we were able to find for the first time that this recycling involves metallic metals, metallic iron and metallic copper. They have never been identified in the human body before, except if people implant copper in their body, but naturally, never. And suggests that there's really novel chemistry. And further, in the case of iron being metallic, it is not known to even be able to exist in the earth, because as soon as metallic iron gets exposed to air, it rusts immediately. So how does the amyloid protect it? How is it all working together? So we have, and this is very common in research, I and others usually think of the simplest idea, and that's what the amyloid cascade idea was. It was a good idea to start with. Then you do research, and usually you find your initial idea is not right, that it's something much more interesting, but really interesting things are hard to imagine, so you have to do it in steps. So in this case, what we had thought before is that amyloid encapsulated the metals so that they didn't cause oxidative damage. Now, we still think that, but we think that it actually plays a role in changing them in a way that's never been described before. And we did this using a very unique instrument in England, together with a collaboration with a group in England that works at Oxford. And it's an X-ray microscope hooked to a synchrotron. So a synchrotron is like the huge oval thing that produces X-rays. And we were able to actually directly determine the type of metals that are there. So that's one thing I'm looking at. And then I'm looking at how neurons die during the disease and others. Will these things be important in therapeutics? Yes, because if you could understand how what the metals are doing, it isn't as simple as removing the metals. That's already been tried by someone who I collaborate with in times. It didn't have benefit because it's more complicated than that. But understanding that pathway could give you different ways. And it's not a question of removing the amyloid. It may be a question of producing, maybe you want more amyloid or you want more of a certain type.
Interesting. It's wonderful that I guess we have a platform to share these findings, right? And I think it's just more and more important folks who are living with dementia, caregivers and families, I mean, have these kind of conversations, ask these questions to their, you know, physicians, neurologists and so forth, empower them. So I think it's great. Now, with regard to artificial intelligence, so how has artificial intelligence assisted in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or other diseases linked to dementia?
So far, it is just in the nascent stage, in the beginning stage that people are using it. There have been some publications that have come out. I would say the more important piece, rather than saying a sophisticated AI, is more automated screening. As that's really come about. And there are several mechanisms for doing that. For example, the Alzheimer Foundation of America, you can have a free screen. Anyone can do it. And they even have where the nurse or practitioner even will be involved virtually with that. Does that take the place of a full neurological exam? No. But it's better than not having it. So there are a lot of people who are trying to develop computer-based screening tools. So Mintrax is the one, the Alzheimer Foundation of America, but other companies are doing it. And I think that approach, either whether computer-based approaches, really are important. You have 6 million people in the United States who have this. The PET analysis in 30 million worldwide, or if not more. And you need to have something that's really inexpensive and also really non-invasive. So you have the PET analysis, positron emission tomography, with the amyloid. It's $3,000 to $5,000, only can be done in specialized centers. Exposes the patient to large amounts of radiation, which can have health consequences, increased cancer risk, etc. So then you can have a cerebrospinal fluid test. That's, at least for the United States, is not standard because it's considered to be pretty invasive. In Europe, it's very standard to take cerebrospinal fluid. Is that a useful test? It could provide useful data, but again, it's not useful to do all the time. And then people have been developing blood tests at various points and saliva tests. Those are still nothing AI related. So the AI has been more in the cognition and more in the analyzing of MRI. And I'd say that all of that so far is not ready for prime time. And I've seen a lot of comments about the recent paper saying it didn't really add that much, the one that used AI. And we have, I'm editor-in-chief of the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, and we have AI papers. And there's certainly in the research arena, you know, where you're developing new techniques, definitely AI is an important element. But in terms of public health, I don't think it's ready.
So basically, continue to put focus on more of a human-centric effort.
I think the human-centric effort is really important for multiple reasons. One is that treating each person as an individual, because different people will lose different capabilities. So working with each one, not just saying, oh, your mother is 85, what do you expect? I mean, I had a mother that lived to 90, and I remember a story she would tell of going to the physician about some health issue. And they'd say, wow, you're, you know, 85, what do you expect? And that's what I told her would be the case. You should expect to live every day to the fullest and have physicians supporting you for that. Other part is really having neuropsychological tests, understanding, do you really have Alzheimer's disease? Another part of this piece, and I've already alluded to this, is depression. So if you think about it, you know, the 85-year-old has probably lost their spouse, may have financial issues, may have had to move once or twice. They have a lot of things happening in their life, most of which are not pleasant. Are they adaptable? And think about, are you as adaptable when you're 85 as when you're 45? Not likely, okay? So helping them with that, whether that means support or whatever it is. That's what I meant about working with each person. And then understanding if they have behavioral issues that maybe some pharmaceutical would help them. Unfortunately, until recently, and even recently, it's still primitive, most drug companies have worked on trying to improve cognition when what families suffer from is the behavior problems.
They're intertwined.
They are intertwined, but you can remember everything. And if you're aggressive or you're wandering, you could become someone that the family can no longer take care of, because either you put yourself at risk, you know, your children, et cetera. So really addressing all of that whole aspect of each person, because not everybody has the same issues.
Person-centered care, absolutely. So let's look 10 years from now. What do you think that in 10 years, will we have a cure for Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia? I guess, why or why not?
Yeah, so I was asked what I thought about the approval. Nature asked me, Nature, the science magazine, asked me about 2 months ago, what did I think? And I said, if this proceeds, it will set back the field 10 to 20 years. And they put that in their quote. Why do I think so? Because the pharmaceutical industry says it'll really lead to a renaissance. It won't lead to a renaissance. It'll lead to more focus on amyloid. So they will design more variations. Already, Lilly is trying to get its drug approved, which does something very similar to Biogen's. Roche will get theirs. And the other companies will make theirs, because it's not that complicated to do once you know the path. So that's one possibility. That's a really sad one that will be wrapped up. And will it be worse than it's been? No, it'll be just the same. No, the field's stagnating. The opposite is, at the same time, with limited funding, I see a lot of innovative ideas coming out of companies and others. So, you know, the basic thing is that there's an appeal to authority. I write, a friend of mine or colleague in Boston sent me some group that he wanted me to get involved with. And I won't name the group, but a particular new thing that I hadn't heard of. It's a European-based thing. And he said, well, do you know any of the people that are already involved? I looked, and the business people I didn't know. But I did know the scientists, and I did know some of the people that were involved in foundations. And it was just prior to this call, so I hadn't responded. And I also should think about before before I respond, because I thought, wow, these are the same people that have held back the field all these years. The same people are involved because they're very prestigious, they're very smart, articulate, etc. And I remember one of them I dealt with, I was asked to help design the X Prize, which is something to, you know, it was when the SpaceX was formed. And they wanted to have one in Alzheimer's disease. And I worked on it with a friend, and it got hijacked by one of these people to eventually form something that was totally non-novel and is going to go nowhere. When I was just about ready to lose it in that case, and his friend talked me out of getting angry because there was no point. So the same people control what's happening and only say they're promoting innovation, because the same people played a role in rerouting the Gates Foundation money and others. And it just ends up going down the same path. If that's the case, we will be having the same conversation 10 years from now. Nearly five years ago, I debated Risa Sperling at the American Academy of Neurology. In fact, that's where I met Alberto.
Oh, Esper. Okay.
And he did a podcast to me after the debate. So I debated her. I won the debate, probably just barely, but I won. And at the end, the closing of that, she said, well, I hope to be able to debate you in 5 years to talk about the advances, you know, I've made. Well, 5 years has happened and there's no advance. But I said, wouldn't it be sad if we're back here 15 years from now and we're still having the same debate? Whether I win or not doesn't make any difference. That's, you know, that's pointless. It's whether we've really advanced. So I am optimistic that I will make progress in my area. But if I look at the whole picture together, I think it may just continue down the same path. And so you've asked also, or will be asking, you know, like whether there's a lot of money for funding. And the answer is the government has put more money than in the past. They've quadrupled the funding over the last several years.
Funding towards the amyloid theory? Funding towards what?
They, if you ask them, they'll say that they're not spending it on the amyloid theory. But if you look at the reality, that's where it is. So there's the amyloid theory is kind of a contrast, because we recently published in Journal of Alzheimer's Disease Reports, which is the online version of JAD, and somebody did a survey, and it was a minority idea. Only a minority buys into the amyloid theory, but they are the best funded, the most published. So, you know, the political power is not just by a number of voters. It's, you know, the right voters. Right, the influencers. And so they're still influencing a lot. And the pharmaceutical industry has something that scientists and laboratories don't have. Once they get stuck down a certain path and file all their patents, it's really hard for them to move and suddenly move on a dime to something else. They usually do it by, you know, sacking all the people that are in that division and hiring a new group. So it's very different than the way scientists function.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just more and more important for families, caregivers, and folks living with dementia to empower them and give them a stronger voice in bringing these concerns. I mean, they're the user of the drugs, right? They're buying it, they're paying, and they're using it. And I think you and I can talk about it. I mean, I have my personal journey, but I think we need to advocate with those living with dementia more and more and normalize conversations like this. Very important.
Correct. But you've probably seen that many of these patients are being utilized by the pharmaceutical industry. They're saying how important it is, and so they're really appealing to their hopes.
And they really are.
Hope is an important element. I understand that.
It's false
but
hope.
But that is not what modern medicine is about. It's based on scientific, in other words, scientific, it's demonstrable. And this And the other piece, the way in which we approve these drugs, even if the drug did work, if you look at the statistical thing, if you had to treat 100 mothers to see an effect, would your mother be one out of 100? When you give a drug to a person, you expect that it'd be highly likely that they would respond in a positive fashion, not one out of 100 or five out of 100. And that's the best that's being claimed right now, is something like that. It's a small effect on some patients that you wouldn't even be able to detect, except if you were a trained neurologist.
Well, I appreciate all your wisdom and just insight and your passion in this work and serving folks with dementia. Do you have anything else that you would like to share?
I want to share back at the same point we started in, that Alzheimer's disease is a social construct, and how we view that social construct. I'm not talking about, you know, there's a biology of that, that's biology. But how we view somebody who's demented, who has diminished capacity, and how we interact with that person and view them is going to make a difference in us and them and the impact. And by just changing that view, so I have this view of amyloid and Alzheimer's disease that also relates to this. So we look at it and we say, gee, isn't it horrible somebody becomes demented at 85? Then you can turn around the same way. Isn't it amazing that some people live to 100 and have complete mental capacity? I mean, they're less active. What did they have? So how does the brain maintain itself to be normal? Just changing, looking at half full versus empty, you have a different view. So if you look at that 100-year-old person, their brain's full of plaques and tangles. So how are they able to be normal? You could say, well, they would have became demented next year. Well, if everybody lives long enough, you know, if you live to 125, maybe you'll be demented also, though there are people who live to those ages that are not demented. So it isn't a foregone conclusion. The other part about the risk of having the disease, although you have family members that are affected, the risk, lifetime risk of you or somebody in your family having Alzheimer's disease is actually not that high. It's about 20% or so. The fear of Alzheimer's disease is 85% of people are fearful of it. So it's very disproportionate. And it's the opposite of what it is for heart disease, the opposite of what it is for cancer, you know, all debilitating conditions. So we have a fear more of it. Is it because we've lost cognition and control, or is it we're just fearful of things like it? I think coming to terms with Alzheimer's disease is an important element. We're all want a cure, but what if Alzheimer's disease is really hard to cure before we really, number one, we don't even barely know what it is. It's more than plaques and tangles and genes. And maybe the cure will be 20, 30, or 40 years from now. When the companies are selling it, very often they're selling as if the people that are demented right now are going to gain from any of this treatment. That is not true for the Biogen approach or any of these antibody approaches. They're all given to people during the early phases of the disease. So people that are already frankly demented. So what do? The people that are demented still have function, and viewing them in a different context. And having and supporting not just the person with Alzheimer's, the family member. And this is what local Alzheimer's associations and many others do really an excellent job. But even becoming better at that can have changing the view of Alzheimer's disease, not to be so fearful, not to stigmatize it, to view it as this other phase of life. And how can you maximize your performance? How can you maximize what you are then?
I hope people that are listening or watching take all of your wisdom to heart, because it is much needed if you are on the journey caring for a loved one with dementia. So I really appreciate your time. And how do people get a hold of you?
You could email me. Well, you could do it through LinkedIn as you did, or Facebook. I have And I also, very good source for information is the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease Facebook page. I post articles, whether I agree with them or not. I just post everything that I see in the news related to Alzheimer's disease, that Facebook page.
I'll make sure to include that into the show notes. So I'll be visiting there.
And the other part is to email me. You can include that. I'd probably prefer it be my personal email rather than my professional email.
Sure. I will include that.
Okay.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. If you enjoy the podcast, please take a moment to rate and review Boomer Living Senior Living Broadcast wherever you get your podcasts. One of my favorite things is to hear from you, the listener. So please leave a review and let us know what you think. And I read all of the reviews. Also, please pass it along to your friends, family, coworkers, and anyone aging. So please leave a review and I love to hear from you.